Please give a warm applause to our speaker tonight, Bill English.
Thank you. I'll be candid with you. I am far more comfortable doing our monthly introductions and listening to people share their experiences than to share my own, for a couple of reasons. One, the near-death experience for me and for those that have had the near-death experience, it's such a profound event in your life, and it's something that I've held really very sacred in my life because it changed my life so much. It's not that I don't want to share my experience with so many of you that have asked over the years. It's just that I feel uncomfortable because it affected me so much, and it's been so special to me that I'm being a little selfish in that respect. So that's really one of the main reasons why it's very infrequent that I share my experience with anybody. I mean, it's not that I don't believe that my message, and especially the messages that you hear in here, are not valuable, but as so many of our speakers have shared with you, it's a very, very difficult thing to bring out because it's such an emotional experience. You can't really put words to what it has done to me and the people in my life. And so I guess I'm a little guarded in letting those feelings come out. I'm going to kind of work backwards a little bit. As Martin indicated, we've been friends and associates for over 20 years. I first met Martin at the very first meeting of IONS in Utah. Martin, Arvin Gibson, and Lynn Johnson. For many of you, Arvin Gibson was an author as well as a researcher, an incredible individual, has since passed. But the three of them came together and formed our local group. And the first meeting of IONS that I went to was held at the old Cottonwood Hospital, and there were maybe 15 people there. The reason that I went was not that I was seeking validation. I mean, I knew the experience I had was more real than anything else I had really experienced in my life, but it was because I wanted to know if there were other people that this had happened to. I'm fortunate I have my cousin in the audience and his wife tonight, and I'll explain where they come into the picture shortly. For those that did know me before I had my experience, had we gone to Rice-Eccles Stadium at capacity and they would have said, someone in here is going to have a near-death experience and it's going to change their life completely, I'd be looking around at the other 70,000 people wondering who it was, because I really struggled with issues of faith. I struggled with issues of identity. So the near-death experience, really, when it happened, all of those questions and things kind of came into perspective for me. And that's why when Martin said that I had made a comment about that if I had a choice to go back versus living with the blessings that I have today, I couldn't go back. Just couldn't do it. So, nor would I want to. So anyway, I've moved backwards now to get to what happened. July 24th weekend, 1991, my brother and I had decided to make a trip out of Utah to go up to St. Anthony, Idaho, and do some four-wheeling and just kind of check out the area up there, a beautiful part of the country, and it's a place I'd never really been. It was the 26th of July. I was dating a girl at the time, and the reason that we couldn't go actually on the 24th is she was working at the University Hospital and had to work until the 26th, so we went up early in the morning of the 26th. We got up there, and we set up our camp, and my brother and I decided that we would just go out and kind of check the area out and decide what we were going to do for the next several days. We were probably about 5 miles outside of where our camp was, and I told my brother, because his son was there and my girlfriend at the time, I said, well, we probably ought to be heading back. So we started heading back. My brother was in front of me. I mean, we weren't speeding, weren't being crazy, we were just heading back. The sand up in St. Anthony is very different than sand in the Utah area. It's more like a powder. You could pick it up and blow it. It's a very light powder. As such, it hides a lot of defects. It looks like something is perfectly smooth, and you might hit it, and it might be something that's 2 feet deep. Apparently, on the way back, we were just coming over some roads and some very gentle rolling hills. I was traveling maybe about 25 miles an hour max, and I'm assuming that it was hitting that defect, because the last thing I really remembered was the vehicle making an abrupt turn to the left and starting to flip. The next conscious memory I had was I remember hitting on my head, and I was wearing a helmet, but it was such an incredible pain, didn't even register. It was just something that just went right off the scale initially, and then I was out. And I just remember that flash of just pain beyond anything I could remember. I don't know how long I was unconscious, because my brother was ahead of me. At some point, he realized I wasn't behind him, and he turned around and came back. And when he came back, I was underneath the machine. I was still unconscious, and he was able to arouse me, and he said, "What's going on?" And I said, "Well, what happened?" And I remember my head was turned, and he said, "Your machine's on top of you." And my machine weighed probably, I don't know, 700-800 pounds. It was not something he could move. And I just told him, I said, "I can't feel anything." And at that time, I had no sensation from my neck down. I told him, I said, "You've got to go get some help." I was cognizant enough. I knew I had received some type of spinal injury. One, because I couldn't feel anything on my body. I couldn't feel the machine on me. Couldn't feel anything below my neck. And I knew my brother was going to have to leave, so I asked him, I said, "Would you, if you can find some rocks or something, put something around my head that will A, immobilize my neck, but B, if somebody happens to come along, maybe they'll realize that I've got a neck injury and they won't move it until medical people get here." He did that, and he said he got about a mile away from where I was, and he ran into another group of people. He told them what happened, and the group split. Half came back to help him, and then one or two rode on into where we were at to call the paramedics. They came back, and they removed the machine off my back, and I was kind of in and out of consciousness during this period, because I kind of remember them talking about how they were going to get the machine off. Then I don't remember anything else. And then the next memory I had, I guess I had been out for a fair amount of time, because the paramedics had arrived and they called for a helicopter. I just remember hearing one of them talking to the helicopter, and he said they were 29 minutes out. Then the next thing I remember is getting a blast of the sand and the dirt as the helicopter was landing, and they had something over my face. Kind of came to a little bit in the helicopter ride, and then we arrived at the hospital in Idaho Falls. I was taken into the emergency room. Like I said, I was in and out of consciousness. I'll tell you the injuries that I had and what was taking place. I sustained a closed head injury. I had a cervical spine injury. My back was broken. I had a compression fracture at T4, a burst at T5. All of my ribs were broken. And I had a pneumothorax in my right lung, a hemothorax in my left lung, and traumatic pancreatitis. Because of the hemothorax in my left lung, that was where the lung was filling up with blood, they thought that I had torn my aorta, and they were asking for permission, because I was kind of in and out, and it was before my brother was there, because I went by helicopter and he had to drive there, get his son, my girlfriend, and drive there. And I guess it was probably about an hour drive for them to get to the hospital. During this time, I was kind of in and out, but I was also, they had done a CT scan, and they kind of had an idea of how severe the injuries were. And the first thing was, is they said they probably were going to have to do open heart surgery, because they thought I had, again, the torn aorta. and the doctor was asking if I would give surgical consent. I said, well, if you don't operate, what's going to happen? And he said, in all likelihood, you will die. You'll bleed to death because we can't control the bleeding unless we do surgery. And I said, okay, fine, let me die. And they're like, what? I was very serious. I wasn't being flippant. I was dead serious because I knew I was paralyzed. And what had just been handed to me at that moment was actually a fate worse than death. I was a very athletic person. At the time I had my accident, I was actually training for a triathlon. I was in very, very good shape. And the thought of never, I mean, and again, I told you I couldn't use my hands at that time. I was completely paralyzed. But the thought of being paralyzed, being a quadriplegic or paraplegic, was actually far more frightening to me than living. I told the doctor, I just said, no, I'd rather die than live with this. And their hands were tied at that point until my brother got down. And my brother arrived sometime after that, and I guess they had a discussion with him. And my brother said they had asked him to go in and to talk to me and to try to get me to change my mind. And he came in, and his name is Bob, and I said, look, Bob, you know who I am. You know the kind of person I am. I go, I really would rather die than to live with what they've just told me I have to live with. So he went back to the doctors, and he said, he's my brother, and I have to respect his wishes. It may not be what I would do, but it's his life. I have to go along with what he wants. Well, because of where I was at and the severity of my injuries, I needed to be in a trauma one center. They were not a trauma one center. There were two options. They could either fly me to Boise or they could fly me to the University of Utah. Because we lived in Salt Lake, the decision, my brother said, well, let's take him to Salt Lake. So they called for an air ambulance to fly up, and I was medevaced back to Salt Lake. I don't remember anything really beyond my conversation with the doctor and my brother. Because like I said, I was in and out of consciousness, and I think probably they were giving me something, sedation at that point. Well, things went from bad to worse. Not only did I have all the injuries that I told you, but now I was developing a condition called ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome. It almost had 100% mortality rate. What it is it's where your lungs go into shock and they just fill up with fluid and there's absolutely really nothing they can do. I was very fortunate that once I was actually down here, I'm kind of skipping ahead, but like the world's leading expert in ARDS happened to be at LDS Hospital, and they brought him from LD up to the U to treat me. Anyway, I lapsed into a very deep coma. I was flown down to Salt Lake. Bob came down on the aircraft with me. My girlfriend, she had got a hold of some friends or family, but anyway, somehow she got the kids back and stuff back to Salt Lake. While I was in the hospital, my condition was deteriorating quite rapidly. My mother was in California. My youngest brother lived in Puerto Rico, was a pilot in the Coast Guard. And so it was just Bob here and some extended family, cousins. And Bob was just really kind of beyond himself and knew that I was in bad shape. And so what he did was he contacted my cousin Tom, who's in the audience. Tom, say. And I may have him come down and help me out here because he's been such a special part of my life. He asked Tom if he would come to the hospital and give me a blessing because they weren't sure I was going to really pull through. So Tom came to the hospital with my brother's brother-in-law, and they gave me a blessing. At that time, I was in a deep coma. I was on full life support. I don't remember any of it. From what they told me, there was a line or a wire in every part of my body. Literally, to even be close to me, you had to stand about 10 feet away. There was so much medical equipment going on in the ICU, and set alarms going off constantly, so I guess it was pretty chaotic for people that were coming in to see me. Anyway, Tom came and was giving me a blessing. I'm not LDS. As Tom was giving me the blessing, I could feel his hands on my head. I could feel the warmth of his hands. I could hear everything he was saying. And at the same time, I could see people starting to gather around me and placing their hands on me. And some of these people I knew, some I didn't know, but they all had kind of one thing in common. They were deceased. These were people from my family, people I'm assuming that were from my family, that gathered around me as this blessing was taking place. I could feel the warmth, I could feel the love, and the perception that I had was, and I don't know if it was or it wasn't, but I perceived that they were healing hands that were being placed on me. But the confusing part to me was, I could feel that, I could hear everything that was going on, but I was watching it from up here. And I'm looking down, and my first thought when I saw this person down there was, man, that guy, I feel really bad for him. Yeah. Glad it isn't me. And then it started to register. It's kind of like I'm going back and forth, like, what is going on? And as this blessing was being given, like I said, I could feel the presence of these people around me, and I could feel the love, I could feel the warmth. There was a tremendous sense of peace that I was feeling, but at the same time I was really confused. It was like, I need to be one of two places. I either need to be back in my body or I need to be up here, but this is really confusing me, being kind of feeling what's going on down here but seeing it from here. And I was just really struggling with that. That was really the last thing that I remember about this part. And the next part I'm going to talk to you about, and I'm only guessing because I think this event, time-wise, occurred towards the end of the period that I was in my coma. During this period of time, my mom and my brothers had told me they had been called to the hospital at least 7 times and told that I had either arrested or they didn't expect me to live for more than a couple hours and they needed to get up there. I mean, in my condition, just because of, A, the injuries I had, I mean, they couldn't do anything for the injuries because the one problem, I mean, besides the ARDS I developed with the traumatic pancreatitis, they can't give you any anesthetic. They couldn't do anything surgically to intervene. It was just trying to stabilize me medically, however they could, until I either passed or recovered. So there was this up and down during the several weeks that I was in this coma. And the reason why I think that this was towards the end of that was because the doctors were starting to have conversations with my family about the chance of him surviving is negligible. There is a very good chance that he has suffered irreversible brain damage, that in all likelihood he will either A, be a vegetable, or B, require institutional care for the rest of his life. You might want to have a conversation amongst yourselves about taking him off life support. That's why I think this next event occurred towards that end, because pretty much my condition from day one to this point was down. There weren't really any improvements. There were just decreases in my condition day by day. Well, anyway, the next thing I remember is I found myself in this incredibly beautiful meadow, a place beyond description. I had never seen anything so beautiful, so peaceful. The flowers, the grass, the sky, everything was just beyond description in terms of how it was. The thing that was so amazing, I was on this path, was that as I looked around, everything was interconnected. It was all at the same level. The grass, the flowers, the sky, anything that I saw was on the same plane that I was. It wasn't that I was above, everything was interconnected. As I was coming down this pathway, I noticed off to my left down below, there was a stone archway, and I could see inside there, and there was a garden area. And I was drawn to it. There was a light drawing me to that garden area. I continued down this path. As I was on this path, something dawned on me. I realized I either had died or I was in the process of dying. That wasn't frightening to me, but I had this thought at that moment that I would never see my children again. For those that knew me before, I was the poster child for type A personalities. Very driven. I accomplished a lot of things. I acquired a lot of things. But my life was about things. I was divorced. I have three children. And I did love them. But the way that I expressed my love to my children was like if they questioned, well, you know, you don't love me. And I would, well, how can you say I don't love you? Look at everything. I was showing my love by giving them things, and what they really wanted of me was to give myself. And it wasn't that I didn't love them, I just didn't know how. That was the way I did it. Like I said, I had this feeling that I'm never going to see my kids again. And it was a pain that actually, at that moment, exceeded the pain I experienced when I hit my head. It was that painful thinking, I am never going to see my children, and I'm never really going to have the opportunity to tell them how I really feel, and that I'm sorry that I wasn't there the way I should have been. That pain stayed with me until I got down and I went through the archway. And as I entered into the archway, directly in front of me was my dad. My dad had died 6 years prior to that. I was with him when my dad died. And I remember when my dad passed, we had really struggled with hanging on to him. And there was a doctor that was in the hospital that came in and said he had lost his dad about 4 months prior and had gone through a similar situation. And he just said, look, we can keep your dad alive. We can breathe for him. We can keep his heart going. But your dad's never going to leave here. He will never have a quality of life. If my dad had cancer, he just said, it's really best to let him go. My dad at this point was going into what they call the Stokes breathing, where he would take a breath and then he'd stop for like a minute and your heart would stop. You just didn't know if he was gone or if he was going to come back. And it was just up and down, and we were really struggling. None of us wanted to let him go. So after meeting with that doctor, we all took a few minutes and we agreed as a family that we were going to let my dad go. And what the doctor said before he left us is he said, look, your dad is in no pain. What I can do, I can give your dad morphine. Not because he's in pain, he said, but morphine is a respiratory inhibitor and it will probably end things for your father very peacefully. And we as a family agreed that we would do that. Swear to God, as the nurse was coming in through the door, after we had agreed, we were all in there with my dad, that we were going to let him go, my dad died. And I think it was just, he needed to know that we would let him go. The reason that I bring this up is because that was probably the first time in my life that something inside me said something very special just happened to my dad. My dad was a long dying process. I mean, all the color had gone out of him as things started going on through the extremity, the breathing situation. At the moment my dad died, all of the color came back in his body, and he honestly looked 20 years younger. You could see the peace on his face. It wasn't just the physical thing that I saw. There was something very perceptible that had just occurred. You knew he was no longer there, but you knew something special had happened to him. At that time, I thought, maybe there's more to this than I'm giving credit for. But again, I struggled with faith. Kind of the interesting thing about faith that for me that I found is that when everything's going great, there's an abundance of faith. When everything goes, pardon me, to hell, that's when you start questioning faith. It's like, well, where is it? It's not like you can go to the store and say, hey, I'm running short on faith. Can you give me $20 worth? It just doesn't work. But faith had been an issue. I entered into the courtyard, and there was my dad in front of me. He looked amazing. He was just completely bathed in light. And he approached me, and he embraced me. And really, we had a very brief encounter. I told my dad, I said, I'm really lost and I'm confused. Because I didn't know, am I dead? Am I dying? What's going on? And my dad embraced me and he said, you're no longer going to be lost or confused. It's not your time to be with me. You need to go back and everything's going to be okay. He didn't say I was going to be healed. Didn't say I was going to be walking, running, being a jerk like I was before. He just told me everything was going to be okay. And that when it was my time to come back, he would be there. He took me back to where that archway was, and that's the last thing I remember. The reason that, again, I'm putting it timeline at the end of when I was in this comatose period is because my condition had been bang, 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 and then all of a sudden, 180-degree turn. My body started responding to the therapy. I was fighting the ventilator that I was on, so they were starting to wean me off the ventilator. Came out of the coma, still on the ventilator for several days. I remember the first time I could consciously communicate with my mom, and it was my youngest brother, Tom, who had come in from Puerto Rico, like, are you okay or whatever. I just looked at them and I said, I'm fine, I've been with Dad. And you would think, with somebody just coming out of a coma and giving that statement, you'd be hitting the call button, get somebody in here, he is seriously wigged out. But the thing was, they totally accepted that. Tom, could you come down with me for just a minute, because maybe you can help here. When I came back, I actually physically felt like I was connected to both realms. That I was not only here, but I was still very connected there. When I was in the hospital, they almost threw me out because of this, I think. So many people came to see me that the hospital was changing the rules about visitation. And it wasn't because I was this amazing person. I was like, why are you guys doing this? I was cordial to people, but I was kind of at a place before this where it was like, whatever. And I didn't really need anybody or anything. I kind of had it all worked out by myself, and that's where I was at. They would come, and they said that there was actually a physical aura that was around me, and that when you came into my room, you could feel it. It was so nurturing and so healing to them that they weren't coming to help me. They were coming to have me help them, and I didn't get it. I was like, I think you guys need to go one floor up. I think that's the psych ward. You know? That was going on, and I'll have Tom kind of help fill in some of this too, but I remember when I started kind of coming around a little bit, I was very angry at God. I had a conversation, and I have no doubt in my mind who the conversation was with. I can almost remember verbatim what I said is like, how could you do this to me? And the response was, how can you believe that I would do this to you or anyone? You're a parent. You know you love your children. By loving your children, you can teach them, you can guide them, and you can protect them to a degree, but in the end, you have to let them make their own choices. And the choices that our children make can sometimes bring us great pleasure. They can sometimes bring us great pain. They can do the same for themselves, give them either great pain or great satisfaction in the choices they make. But please understand that no one did anything to you, and you know, I didn't do anything to you. What happened to you was because of choices that you made. God would not intentionally hurt me, but I was, at that time, I was looking for somebody to blame on what had happened to me and why. It was such a loving conversation that I had. I think it's kind of important because this is a person that's known me since the moment I was born. I mean, my cousin Tom. And I think he can be very helpful, not only because of what he did for me in my blessing. My family was kind of disjointed. Well, not kind of, it was. It was very disjointed. We would see each other and we weren't really close. We didn't really do things as a family. And it wasn't me, but I believe it was this experience that brought us all together. And we now have a very strong and a very close family. That, to me, is another blessing of this experience. It not only opened my eyes and my heart, but it brought my family together. It gave me a family, something that I had really neglected to take part in. I'm going to let Tom just kind of share a few words. I think the one thing that of all the experience, you know, that I hear lots of them, obviously, is because I had somebody that was a witness to the experience. And I was in the hospital for a year. Christmas Day in the Spinal Cord Injury Center in Seattle, where I was transferred to, a FedEx guy comes in, and I go, "What are you doing working on Christmas?" And he said, "Are you Bill English?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "I have a package for you." Tom had taken the time to sit down and write my experience, and he sent it to me as a gift Christmas Day. Pretty special. So this is my cousin Tom, and I think the thing that I'm grateful for is he and the rest of my family are in my life. I'm grateful for the fact that I have somebody that can not only benefit from a near-death experience, but was there to witness it with me. Tom, maybe you can add a few things.
First of all, I'm like this. Bill's younger than me, but if you look up here, he's catching up. So the first thing I got to do is disclaim. He says what I did for him. I'm LDS, and I did help give him a blessing, and it was a very special experience, but I didn't do anything. I asked God to bless him and give him peace and comfort, and that's what happened. I take no credit for that. I give all the credit for that to God. And that was, but let me tell you how I found out he was hurt. I was working for Quaker Oats, and I can't remember what we had a meeting in Disneyland, and we planned on taking the family down, and I called Bill's mom, my Aunt Roseanne, to say, "Can we stay with you?" And she said, "Sure, but I won't be there. I'll leave the key." And she said, "Bill's been in a serious accident up in Idaho, and I'm leaving as soon as I can to get up there and see him." And then the next thing I do is I get a phone call from his grandma, who was like a grandma to me, really. His grandma and grandpa, we were, he says we weren't close, but we were really close, especially as kids. We did a lot of things together. And she asked me, was a devout Catholic, and she says, "Will you give him a Mormon blessing?" She says, "Billy's hurt bad and he needs all the blessings." Then my cousin Bob, if you've ever met him, he calls me right after that, and he's in tears, and he says, "You got to come up and give Billy a blessing. He's really bad." And so he wanted his brother-in-law to come with me, and we drove up to the university hospital, and he was in this trauma IC care unit. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that, but we walked in there, and they had all these little rooms. They weren't really rooms. They were just curtains. Every person in there had some serious injury. I remember one guy that had been in a motorcycle wreck, and, he was really bad looking. Billy, like he said, was in pretty good physical condition, and I don't remember a bruise being on his body or anything. He looked like he was just resting, but he had all kinds of wires all over him. And these guys are so bad when they're in there that they have one nurse assigned to him to monitor him 24 hours a day, just taking care of him. His body looked physically fit, no bruises, no signs of any injury that you could see. He was the best looking guy in the whole place, I can tell you that. Everybody else was pretty hammered. But he was in critical condition. He was on a respirator. They'd had to kind of sedate him because when they didn't, he was trying to pull the tubes out and all that kind of stuff. And we gave him a blessing, and I remember basically all I asked was that he could just have peace and comfort, that he would be all right. He may not get better, but he was going to have love and support from his family. And then we went down to Disneyland, had a great time, and came back. And he didn't have health insurance when this happened, but he's a Vietnam vet. He was a door gunner in the Marine Corps on helicopters. So as soon as the university found out he didn't have insurance, and as soon as they got him stabilized, they sent him right over to the VA hospital where he got marvelous care. And when we came back from California, I think we were gone about 3 weeks, they had him on this table that was tipping him side to side. And I can't remember what she said on that, but the nurse said, he's going to come out of this. He's starting to respond to me. And he still had the respirator and all that stuff, but she said, Bill, can you squeeze my hand a little bit? And he would just start squeezing her hand. I'd heard about near-death experiences, but I just kind of brushed them off, maybe. Sounds interesting, but then my aunt Carol, who was up at the hospital with us with Bill's mom, she calls me up. She says, Billy wants to see you. I get into this room, and he's awake, and he's talking. He told me, he says, you must have an 800 number to God, and I want to know about it. What did you do? And I says, don't give me credit. I have no credit. But I remember he told us he'd been with his father, and he'd seen him, and everything was going to be all right. And then he says, but I learned, and this is a kid, oh, I can tell you, never had any spirituality or feelings. Like he said, he was just 100% materialistic. He says, I want to tell you, the most important thing in this life is love, loving your family and your good friends. And you got to really take care of them. And he was really emphasizing that. Even though he was hurt and he was paralyzed, he said, that's the most important thing I learned. And he was teaching us stuff that he learned that I knew from going up with him that he had never learned in his life experiences because he was so materialistic. He got stabilized there, and then they had to send him up to the VA hospital. Was it in Seattle?
Yeah.
To kind of rehab him. He had to learn how to take care of himself in a paralyzed condition. And I can't remember how long he was up there, but I'd call him once in a while. And I had started taking notes on this thing, and I thought, what can I do for Billy at Christmas? And then I decided to write down, it's not very long, it's about 7 or 8 pages is all, and I sent it to him for Christmas. He called me, and it was a pretty emotional experience for us to do that. One thing about these near-death experiences, I mean, I believed in him after that. I've always believed in God and Christ, but when he had this experience, it was faith-promoting for me and strengthened me. Just as a little sidelight, if he went to heaven, I know I'm going there for sure. So, yeah, it's a done deal. So, but anyway, what our family's like is my father was LDS and my mother was a convert when she married my dad years ago. And my mother's side of the family wasn't. But we always got along really good. After he had this experience, how all the cousins have rallied around and supported him. For a family as old as we are, all the cousins are in their 50s and 60s now. Some of us approaching 70, but we're really close, and it's been a blessing. And I think that experience is what brought us closer together. We do have a good family. We get together several times a year and really enjoy each other. I believe he had it because what he taught us, what he learned in that short period when he was in that coma, and I can't remember how many weeks it was, the guy that I knew before and the guy after were guys, and he was taught things during that period that he did not learn on his earth life. That's it for me right now.
Thank you, Tom. One thing I will add is I told you about my relationship with my kids. They were kind of questioning the doctors, I'm sure, at great length about the body snatcher that took the real dad out of the body that they were left with and stuffed this other guy back in there because now they had this slobbering, emotional guy that was loving them and wanting to hug and kiss them and wanted to be around them and have this great relationship. And they're like, you need to do something because that isn't our dad. Fix him, whatever you got to do, because clearly you missed something in your assessment. Since that time, I've had an incredibly wonderful relationship with my children, with my extended family, and with friends. And the reason that I stay with IONS is because I believe that the near-death experience is really, it's not about dying. It's really about the message of living. And there's nothing magical about what happened to me or to other people that have had experiences. At very best, we had a peak. I don't have all the answers, but what it does do is it instills faith in me and hopefully through me and other people that share their experiences here is that it gives you faith that this isn't the end, it's a beginning in many ways. It's just this is one phase of that life that we have here in our immortal life, and that the people that have been in our family that we love, that we will be united with them again, and that I have a very strong belief that maybe oversimplified, but we talk about the veil often, and in the LDS faith, the veil I don't believe that veil is that thick. The connection between those that we have lost and for us, it's not that big of a span, that they're still very much with us and still very connected. I'll tell you one just brief story, and then I'm going to turn it over to Martin to kind of help me out here. My mom passed away actually 4 years ago on the 16th of this month, and even though I knew that she was going to a very special place and she would be reunited with my dad, because you've had a near-death experience, it doesn't get rid of the pain of loss and that separation you feel. And I knew my mom was definitely going to a better place and that her suffering was finally over. But I kept having this question, are you okay? That's all I want to know. Are you okay? I knew she was going to be okay. That was one of the things I needed validation on. Because when my mom moved back up from California, we lived together. She came up a few years after I was injured. And she was not only my mother, but we became great best friends. So when I lost my mom, I mean, I didn't just lose my mother. I lost my best friend at the same time. Well, about 6 weeks after my mom died, I was back in my bathroom putting some stuff away. And probably this has happened to all of us here, but you have this sensation that somebody's behind you and you just know they're there, and you turn around and you fully expect to see somebody there. I turned around and there was nobody there, but in that instant, the room filled up with the scent of my mother's perfume. My mother wore a very distinct perfume, and it just lasted about 3 seconds, and it was gone. It was just a very kind of calming, loving, kind of an all right, I'm okay, still with you message. I went crazy. I went through that entire house for probably half a day trying to explain that scent. Then it finally went through my thick head. Remember your own experience. And it was just my mom through that experience letting me know she was okay. That's kind of who I am, what happened to me. I think Martin had some questions, and then we'll
let everybody else ask some. Do you remember how you came back after you had your visit with your dad?
You know, I really don't. I don't have any connection between, it was just going back to the arch and my dad just telling me that it was not my time to be with him. And I don't remember the actual transition from that back into my body, no.
When we first started these IANS meetings years ago, the inevitable question was, how do you know this wasn't some kind of a dream or hallucination or something? But I think we're beyond that. So I'll ask a question that would be designed to elicit the same kind of answers that you would get from that, and that is, could you describe for everyone the quality of what you experienced and how it's different from this life and how real you felt it was? That's the cool answer you get to questions like this.
The main thing is, because it was so profound and it is so vivid, I can remember all of the details as if it just happened. I could have had a dream last night, greatest dream in the world. I wake up in the morning and go, geez, I can't remember any of it. I'm driving myself crazy trying to remember the dream, and I can't. Through my association with IANS, that's always been something that I found really amazing with the people I've spoken to, is the fact that the near-death experience remains as clear and as pristine, no matter whether it was yesterday or 100 years ago, as it did at the time. And that remains for me. I met a gentleman when we were at Cottonwood Hospital. You may remember him. A guy that was in his 80s. Came to our meeting because he was really struggling. He had drowned when he was 5 years old. And had an incredible NDE. And he told his family about it. And he was basically banished and beaten and everything else. And told never to share that experience again. And yet he remembered it exactly as it occurred all those years later. For me, is that I don't live with my experience every day, no, but it's always there. And kind of like when I talk about it, like in this setting, or if I remember it, I can go back to that love, that beauty. My experience wasn't like a lot of people where they get everything in one big shot. I was in remedial NDEs or something. By comparison, was relatively short, but I would get different pieces at different times since then. It was kind of like, all right, you're ready, we'll give you one more nugget, because at the time you weren't worthy or whatever to get it all. It's kind of like, as my life has progressed, more pieces fell into place about what had really occurred in that experience.
I'm just going to ask one last question. This is a question that probably no one in the audience would know to ask, because they wouldn't know that your son also is in a wheelchair.
That's true.
Could you explain, even though this isn't directly a part of your experience, briefly what happened to your son and how your experience was able to influence and help him? I think this is an amazing story.
Several years after my injury, I get a call about 2 o'clock in the morning from my ex-wife. She was crying. It's up in the Seattle area. My son's name is Chris, and she said, Chris has been very seriously hurt in a snowboarding accident, and he's paralyzed. Literally, it was just kind of like the bottom of my life fell out at that moment. Chris was an incredible snowboarder. He was actually, at the time he was injured, he was doing a photo shoot for a snowboarding magazine. He was slated to go on the U.S. Olympic snowboarding team. From the time he was a little kid, he had a skateboard. And then the skateboard went to snowboarding, and I mean, he just excelled at it. Amazing. He was sponsored by Burton Snowboard, for those of you that didn't know snowboarding, and several clothing manufacturers. And like I said, he was slated to be on the U.S. Olympic snowboarding team, and they were up at one of the resorts outside of Seattle. You'll forgive me, I can't remember which one it was, but it was after the resort had actually closed at the end of the year, because they wanted to do their photo shoot when nobody was around in this particular setting. Because the temperatures had warmed up, what they were doing is they were coming down this face of this mountain, and they were going off this cliff, and there was a road underneath, and then they would come down the other side. So they were probably 70 to 100 feet off the ground, and I guess the visual that they were getting was pretty spectacular, because it was just all in the air with this mountain backdrop. Well, they had done their photo shoot in the morning, and they took a lunch break, and they went back, and Chris was the first one to come down. Well, because the temperatures had warmed, the snow had warmed up. And Chris made the same run that they had made all morning long, but because the snow had warmed up, he didn't have enough speed to clear the road. And so he made the jump, so instead of landing on the downward side of the slope, he came straight down and landed flat on the road and broke his back, shattered. He had a similar fracture to what I have, a compression fracture. I immediately, the next morning, I flew up to Seattle, went to there, and Chris and I had many conversations, and ironically, at the same time Chris was in the hospital, there was a young man that was a first-round draft choice for the Seattle Seahawks, probably a name some of you might know, Mike Utley. First year with the Seattle Seahawks, first-round draft choice, he was a, I think he was either an offensive or defensive lineman. Well, anyway, two other Seahawks and himself went out partying. The two guys were in the front. Mike Utley was in the back seat, and they had these big boombox speakers in the back rear window area. Well, they got in a wreck, hit a pole. The guys in the front really weren't injured, and Mike wasn't injured from the accident. He was injured from the speaker came forward, hit him in the back of the neck, and made him a quadriplegic. Well, Mike and Chris were in the same room, and they were both kind of struggling with their accident. I wasn't being heroic by any means, because my life, I realized after having this experience and everything, that really my body, our bodies, are just the vehicle that gets us around. Who we really are is inside. It doesn't matter how we get around, whether we're sitting, walking, running, being pushed, whatever. Who we really are is inside us. It's not our physical bodies. And I was able to have conversations with that, and Mike Utley and Chris became good friends, and I had a pretty good association with them for a while. But my son was able to go on and become very successful. Chris, right now, is a very highly placed executive with Adobe. He's been with Adobe for probably 11 years, and now he runs a division within Adobe. Very highly respected within that company, and it's done very well. I think because I had developed the relationship with my son after my accident that we didn't have before my accident, and then because I had had my accident, he was laying in bed at the same place I was at one time with, like, my life is over. I will never be the person I was or want to be. And I was able to hopefully help him see that your life has value really regardless of your physical circumstance, that you still can be successful. You can still do everything that you ever wanted to do in your life. You just may have to do it different. And I'm very proud of him. He has been able to achieve that. I think it was, like I said, not me. I think it was just the blessing of the experience that I had that kind of helped for my son.
Thank you, Bill. Let's give Bill a round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you.
First off, thank you. That was just an amazing story. I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Oh, thank you.
My question is, you touched on it earlier, but it has to do with just how real it was, and I want to ask you something very specific, and that is the embrace with your father. Do you remember the sensation? I mean, one thing that I struggle with is a sensation the same or as what we have here in terms of actually felt him, or?
It was being totally encompassed by light and love. I know that probably sounds vague, but that's really what it was. It was kind of like every molecule of my body was sensing and feeling my dad, the love. And again, the light.
Thank you.
You bet.
Did your son have a near-death experience?
No, he didn't.
He didn't go into a coma?
No. It was a tragic accident, and I was grateful that it wasn't worse than it was. Thank
you. Did your body just heal, or was there more miracles that happened to you as you recovered?
I was in the hospital for a year. I was flat on my back for about 7 months. Because I had the traumatic pancreatitis, they couldn't do any surgeries to go in and stabilize my spine, which they normally would do if somebody had a broken back. That'd be probably within hours of arriving in the hospital. But I was in what they call a TSLO brace that was form-fit to my body, and then a Minerva brace that held my neck in place. I was fed by feeding tube and intravenous nourishment for 7 months. Didn't have a miraculous healing, no. But my spine fused the way it was going to be just from being in the brace. It was a break, and the bone fused there. That's kind of why you see a little bit of a bent, broken body here in front of you. Externally, you would go, what's wrong with this guy? But then you look at an x-ray and it looked like a jigsaw puzzle. Everything that you could break was broken. It was just time and being in the hospital.
But the nerves healed, and you're obviously you have arm motion.
Oh, right. Fortunately, the injury, the cervical injury I had in my neck, was not complete. When they're talking about spinal cord injuries, for any of you, they talk about either complete or incomplete. A complete injury means that you have no sensation and no motor. An incomplete injury means you may have motor, or you may have sensation, or you may have both. The injury in my neck was incomplete, and it resolved over time. But the downside as I was healing was the nerves in my arms and my hands were so hypersensitive They had to put a sign up in my room, big sign, please do not touch him or his hands. Just having somebody walk by, just the breeze of somebody going by would set my nerves. It felt like somebody was lighting my hands on fire. That's how sensitive they were. But fortunately, that resolved over time. I mean, it was months, but it did resolve.
The second you said that the experience progressed, it you had subsequent...
Well, what I mean by that is I didn't have other experiences. It was just that aspects of my experience became very clear, and I started to... I was left with more questions than answers, if you will. I had no doubt about what had happened to me, but you hear some people, they can talk for hours and hours about how expansive their experience was. That wasn't mine. As the years went by, more clarity to my experience came. Like I said, and I'm not trying to be flippant, I must have been a hard learner or in remedial NDEs or whatever, but it was kind of like, you're not ready to get it all in one shot, so we'll give it to you in pieces. It's not that I had other experiences, it was the same experience, just more clarity to what actually happened.
Okay, and you don't have any increased clairvoyance like some of the other people have had?
Yeah, I'm wondering why I'm here, you know? No, I don't. I would say I have no special gifts other than the fact that I grew a lot of compassion for people. That's something I'm very grateful for. It's not a gift, it's something we all should have, you know, caring about people in our lives.
When you were in the hospital right at the beginning, and you were still trying to figure out whether you're here or not here, and then you noticed all the family members around you, I was just curious as to what they looked like. Were they lights? Did they kind of look like themselves?
In my experience, those people and my dad, you could recognize who they were, but they were bathed in light. It was a light that was very loving, and I mean, it just exuded peace. That's a word that you'll hear a lot. When you're talking about peace, we're not talking about ending wars or whatever, you are at such a calm, loving place and so connected with everything and everybody around you, you're totally at peace.
Could you tell if they were men and women, or were they all...
Yeah, well, like I said, some of them I knew. Some were aunts, some were grandparents. Some I didn't know. There was a familiarity, but it wasn't like I knew them intimately, like I had met them in my life.
When I talked to him about this experience and what he had, he asked me who was in the room, and I said, well, Lance and I, we had our hands on your head, and then your mom and Aunt Carol and the nurse. And he says, oh no, he says, my body was completely covered with hands. He said, there were a lot of people in there. And I said, I don't know who they are, because I didn't see them. But he made a big point of telling me that he was completely covered with hands by, you know, other people that were in there with us.
Is your experience somewhere where we could read it, or is it wrote down? And
Arvin Gibson interviewed me probably 1992, and I believe it's in his first book.
Thank you.
Arvin Gibson, ARVINGIBSON, Glimpses of Eternity. Thank you.
The one thing, as I told you at the beginning, I don't like to share my experience. If you've gotten something from anything I said tonight, I'm very grateful. It's such a hard thing for me to talk about because it affected my life so deeply. I just kind of want to put it in a very special place in my life and just hold on to it.
I just wanted to say one thing. When you talked about the family and people coming into your room, and the hospital was quite happy to be rid of you because of all the visitors, one of the things that happened for me, number one, I've always been grateful because it was you who actually brought me to IONS. And there was another time about 15 years ago, I was in a really bad space. It had to do with my job, what I was exposed to on a daily basis, and I was so out of balance. And one of the things that Bill may think, he didn't come back with any gifts. I was really depressed and just out of whack. And Bill invited me to dinner, and we went to dinner, and we spent an evening together. And I've never told Bill this. During that period of time, which I don't know was what, 3-4 hours maybe, we went back to Bill's house and I met his mother and we just spent those hours together. And there's something that happens when you're in Bill's presence and you spend time in Bill's presence. And it is a healing thing. It's a very spiritually healing thing. It brought me back to center. A lot of us near-death experiencers, we get off balance and it's really hard to get back if we don't have that spiritual thing is happening for. I would say that Bill came back with an incredible gift and he has helped literally hundreds of people, but I will always remember you put me back together at that time.
Well, thank you, Bonnie.
So I don't so much have a question as I just kind of wanted to add that.
Well, thank you.
So can you share with us some of the golden nuggets that you have learned as far as clarity since your experience?
I don't have a big long list. I really believe that love is one of the biggest. There's two gifts that I was told that we were given. One is love, and that it's about unconditional love. This was part of that conversation I told you about that I had. It kind of went on, and it was about when you give a gift, especially a gift of love, you give it without expectation. That is really what love is about. It's really being able to share love with other people and not making it conditional upon what you get back or what to expect from somebody or something, or measuring their return gift to what you've given. The other part of it is the free agency. I know, and please, this is not meant to be disrespectful in any sense, but my whole concept of God changed when I had this experience, because prior to the experience, my concept was, God, your position in the universe is you're the fixer. We get in trouble, we pray, you fix it, we're all good, we move on. That isn't how it is from my perspective. God will give us every tool that we need, but we do the work. And there are times he will show us how to use those tools, and there are times that he might get the job started, but in the end, his role is to provide us with everything we need to be successful in our lives, to thrive, but we have to make the choice to do the work. Thank you.